Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 24, 2015, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on the Miriam Ibrahim case and international religious liberty. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts. Our first expert is Tina Ramirez, who is the founder and executive director of Hardwire, Inc., a global movement to end religious oppression and advance religious freedom. And our second expert is Professor Thomas Farr, who is a visiting associate professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and senior fellow at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs, and also director of the Religious Freedom Project there. So I think today the way today's call is going to go is we're going to first hear from Tina Ramirez, who's kind of give us an introduction to the case that we're going to talk about, and then Professor Farr is going to comment on that as well as sort of talk about some of the larger issues involved. So without any further ado, Tina, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you. It's nice to be here and to speak about the case with everyone. The organization that I started was very involved with Miriam's case last year, and it's an honor to be able to share with the lawyers some of the legal issues that took place during it. It was very complicated and messy. So as many of you know, on Mother's Day in America last year, a young woman, 27 years old, was sentenced to death in Sudan for apostasy and was charged with 100 lashes for adultery. And it seemed quite crazy on our end why that would be. But in fact, there are about 20 countries around the world that have laws that put people to death for changing their religion, otherwise known as apostasy. Miriam Ibrahim, as soon as we learned about the case, which we had heard about a year ago, so last February in 2014, when she was sentenced, there are many legal complications involved in her case, and so Hardwired had been working over a number of about 3 years inside of Sudan with a number of lawyers and religious leaders to help them draft a new law for the Constitution on religious freedom. And as part of that, they were then able to respond when the case came up related to Miriam. So that was how we ended up actually getting involved with her family. As soon as Miriam was sentenced, they had about 3 days before the court finalized the order. And she was sentenced under Article 126 of the Sudanese Criminal Law of 1991 for conversion, and then under the Sudanese Family Law of 1991 for Muslims. But the problem with both of these laws that she was sentenced under is that they, one, were applicable to Muslims, but two, they were also inconsistent with the current constitution that's in effect in Sudan right now. So in Sudan, the current constitution was a constitution drafted under a comprehensive peace agreement between the North and the South while they were co-sharing or co-partnering in the governance of Sudan. Now, the South has obviously seceded, and so that constitution is undergoing revisions right now, and that was the process that we've been involved in for the last few years. But there isn't a new constitution, so that's the one that remains in effect. However, obviously, the local laws are inconsistent with that. So when Miriam was sentenced, she was sentenced under the local laws or the national laws, and her lawyers that argued her case tried to challenge that based on the constitution and international law that Sudan has acceded to or ratified. So Miriam was sentenced, and she had five Muslim lawyers that worked on her case, which was actually really good, because had she been represented by Christians, and she did try to get some representation by Christians, but they were too afraid to take her case, it probably wouldn't have come out the same way had that been the way it went. The fact that she had Muslim lawyers, they were able to appeal using Islamic law and Islamic arguments, but also international law, and remarkably were able to build up a lot of local grassroots support, which if any of you remember about 7 years ago, there was a case of a British school teacher in Sudan who was accused of blasphemy or make, you know, commenting, saying something offensive about Islam, because she allowed a student to name their classroom teddy bear Muhammad. And they were calling for her death as well. Well, there was a huge outrage at that point. That was only 7-8 years ago. Now, in Miriam's case, you actually saw something quite the opposite. And a lot of that had to do with this time period during the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, where people were beginning to learn about international human rights and learning about democracy and freedom. And then the last few years of trainings that we had done to really build that grassroots movement of local leaders who were able to articulate why religious freedom is in their interest as women, as children, as, you know, different ethnic and religious communities. And so when her lawyers began to challenge her case, they didn't just do it in a silo. They basically had the whole public support behind them, which was remarkable for Sudan and really unheard of in the Muslim world when you see these kinds of cases of apostasy or blasphemy occurring. So that was, I think, what turned the tide on her case. She was in prison for 2 weeks before she had her daughter Maya, and she was forced to deliver while in chains or in shackles on her feet, and she was in a cell about 5 feet below ground, which there are issues there related to both the Torture Convention and the Child Rights Convention under international law that, that Sudan would be accountable for. And then about 4 weeks later, she was released. So the court, basically after a lot of international pressure, decided to drop the charges. At that point, Miriam and her husband and her two children were taken to the U.S. Embassy, where they were given South Sudanese travel documents. Up until that point, I'm just going to mention one thing because it'll build upon what Tom's going to tell you later, Dr. Farr, which is that the U.S. Embassy had, for about a year prior, had met with Miriam's husband and would not help them at all in the case. So the case actually started in September of 2013. And when Daniel Wani, Miriam's husband, went to the U.S. Embassy in Sudan, in Khartoum, they said, she's not an American citizen, we don't need to help, essentially. And he got that response from them pretty consistently. And during the whole time she was in prison, so for those 6 weeks, it wasn't, the U.S. Embassy never met, I think they met once at the very end with her lawyers, but otherwise they never met with her lawyers. They only, the only people that met with her lawyers were the British Embassy coordinated meetings with all of the Canadians and the European countries. And they were, it was the other countries that were actually working on getting her out of prison. But I should mention that Daniel Wani is an American citizen. He's South Sudanese, but he is an American citizen. So it was really, I think, alarming for many members of Congress and other people that the U.S. Embassy was doing so little. And then in the end, when she was released, she was released to the U.S. Embassy, and the U.S. Embassy issued her travel documents, her and Daniel and the children, travel documents to come to the United States, but they issued them from the South Sudanese Embassy. So when they went to the airport to leave the country, they were then held on falsifying documents because neither of them are obviously South Sudanese. And so it didn't make sense why they would be giving them travel documents for that. So they were then, they had new charges then brought against them for falsifying documents, and then additional charges where the family actually appealed her case to the Supreme Court, appealing to the Supreme Court to actually implement the death sentence for apostasy. And at that point, obviously, it got even worse, so she had to remain in hiding in the embassy, and the U.S. was trying to negotiate with the Sudanese government, but they couldn't get anywhere. And so in the end, the Italian deputy foreign minister came over, and actually it was the Vatican that told him, you know, please go and help this woman get her out. And so overnight, the Italian deputy foreign minister came over, negotiated, had a plane, and basically took the family out of the country to Italy. One of the other legal issues involved in the case, outside of the court issues related to Miriam and her apostasy charges, is that the U.S. wouldn't issue her children visas to come to the U.S. or passports or anything, or even for her as the wife of an American citizen, because Daniel wouldn't do a paternity test. And it's been argued in Congress that there wasn't any requirement needed for that. But I just mentioned it as a matter of, like, you know, immigration or refugee law, that that complicated the process further to even get them out of the country. Our goal was never to get them asylum, but to simply say, look, as an American citizen, they should have some kind of rights. And as a matter of U.S. foreign policy on religious freedom, it's in our interest to help, you know, this family, especially since they're related to Americans, to come out. And there's an easy way to do that. So the case is still ongoing, actually, in Sudan. The case about falsifying documents never ended. So it would be very difficult for Miriam and her family to ever go back to Sudan. They still have threats against them. The lawyers have all been given, have all been threatened throughout the whole process. The case is still at the Supreme Court, and then her lawyers have also since appealed the actual legality of the Sudanese criminal law on conversion and apostasy at the Constitutional Court as well. So they're in the middle of that, and if they can get that overturned, then it will affect the case, obviously. And I'll just mention in the end that there were two other people that were sentenced at the same time that Miriam was, but their cases were very quiet. And the problem was that the government actually took the documents from the courts and closed them up, so none of the lawyers could even get those other documents to find out what was happening. But one of them was a woman in a more remote area of Sudan, so she wasn't able to get lawyers, and she was forced to recant her faith, essentially. But then she's been in hiding, essentially, since. Then the second case was a man who was convicted of apostasy and sent to a mental institution afterwards. So those two cases were hushed up kind of pretty quietly once Miriam's got so much public attention in the news last year. But hopefully that gives you a pretty broad overview of what happened and the importance of having people on the ground that were trained in international law and religious freedom and able to articulate some arguments as to why it was in the interest of the people of Sudan to actually advocate for releasing her, you know, instead of, you know, just allowing a death sentence to be upheld under the current laws. Thank you.
Very good. Well, this is Tom. What I thought I would do is expand a bit beyond what Tina has said and talk a little bit about not only how this is an example, even though the end product is a good one, the end of the story is a good one in that Miriam is now away from harm in this country, but how this is an example not only of the failure of the United States Embassy to help during the travail this woman was going through, but how it really is kind of an example of the failure of American foreign policy in a much broader sense. Just in the event that there are those listening who are not all that familiar with our policy, just a quick run through of the basic machinery. The United States policy of advancing religious freedom is based on the 1998 International Religious Freedom Act, passed unanimously, signed by President Clinton, established an ambassador at large and an office inside the State Department, and a separate and independent commission on international religious freedom with the job of providing independent recommendations to the President, the Congress, and sort of being a watchdog agency for the Secretary and, for the State Department. There have been four ambassadors at large, one each under Clinton and Bush, and now two under President Obama, Ambassador David Saperstein, the current ambassador at large for religious freedom, was just sworn in late last week. I suspect some of you were at that event. So he is just getting started as the ambassador at large. I must say, just yesterday I was reading an article talking about Secretary Kerry's remarks at this event. And the article, which was a blog, said something like, well, I've never heard of this Office of International Religious Freedom, and you're to be forgiven if you haven't either. I often use that line in public addresses because so few people, including, alas, in the political people who think about political things simply are not aware that we have a policy or an ambassador or any such thing, which I think is part of the problem. I think that it means that this issue has not been mainstreamed in U.S. foreign policy and in the general discussion among our political elites about what our foreign policy ought to do and what we ought to be doing. I will mention that because of this general inertia and ineffectiveness, that there are attempts ongoing now to amend the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998. But let me just say a word about the evidence for my assertion, which I quickly ran over, that we're not doing very well. Miriam Ibrahim is one example. Alas, there are many examples of this, where the United States cannot be blamed for what's going on in the world, but I think it can be blamed for not doing much about it. If you look at the Pew Research Center statistics, it's been doing a number of reports over the last several years. The latest report, which is up through 2012, shows that 76% of the world's population lives in countries where religious freedom, in effect, does not exist. And in many of these countries, the worst of them, there are about 70, 75. And if you read that list of countries, you would find on it every country in the world that is of vital significance to the national interest, the fundamental national interest, including the national security of the United States. And, of course, it's all of the countries of the greater Middle East, but it also includes countries like Russia, China, India, and beyond that really lack religious freedom. So this has been going on for some time. The statistics compiled by Pew show that the problem is slowly getting worse, that while we're not at the root of the problem, we're not doing anything to even stem the tide of it. And I think it is probably safe to say, fair to say, that there's no country in the world where the foreign policy of the United States, that is to say, its international religious freedom policy, has either reduced religious persecution or, the flip side of that coin, advanced the habits and institutions of religious freedom, either in culture or in law. Why is this the case? Why are there so many problems like those of Miriam Ibrahim? Why is it that we seem to have so little interest? Why do we have these stories over and over again, like the one that Tina told you of the embassy quibbling about whether she's an American citizen and seemingly unaware of the statutory requirement that the United States advance religious freedom? And if that does not include the attempt to get a woman out of an apostasy charge who has been sentenced to death, who has been imprisoned, then I don't know what advancing religious freedom and opposing religious persecution means. Unfortunately, it appears that many of our diplomats do not know what it means. So let me say a few words about why I think this problem exists, if I've demonstrated that it does. And of course, I'm happy to talk more about that if people want to challenge it or have questions or would like more elaboration. I think our policy, which has been there again since 1998, so we're 16 years into this, so we have a track record of three administrations from both policy parties. We have now four ambassadors at large. I think the policy overall has been highly rhetorical. It consists primarily of reports that are required by the law, and these reports are quite important, and they're frankly pretty good, I think. They're given annually on every country in the world. They identify the problem. In addition, there's something called the Countries of Particular Concern list that is supposed to be given annually. It isn't always, but when it comes out, it shows the worst persecuting countries in the world. These lists are important, but if these are the only arrows that you have in your quiver, you're not really accomplishing anything but identifying the problem. You're not attempting to solve the problem. And I think, in a nutshell, that's where we are. If you look at the things that you would look at if you were writing a research paper on this. What is it that you would look for if the United States were actually advancing religious freedom? You would look for a strategy. You would look for evidence that the various foreign policy arms of the United States government had a strategy to advance religious freedom. In this day and time, with the threat of violent Islamist extremism, you might even expect that strategy to be integrated into our national security strategy. Well, as it turns out, this administration has issued two national security strategies, one in 2010 and the most recent just this month, February 2015. And both of them share the remarkable achievement, if you can call it that, of having simply ignored the issue of religious freedom, except for a throwaway line in a couple of places about the travails of religious minorities in the world. But it says nothing about the United States advancing international religious freedom, either in order to reduce religious persecution or to pursue its own national interests. If you look at that national security strategy, I think you will be surprised to see that, and this it shares this characteristic with the 2010 version, there is a section entitled America's Values and how promoting America's values around the world should properly feed into our national security strategy. Personally, I think, depending on what those values are, that's not a bad idea. But you read this document and you would never know that religious freedom, what used to be called the first freedom of the United States Constitution, of American history, and of the American soul, various phrases that have been used, you would never know that that was any part of our values. So it's quite clear to me that the people who think about American interests in the world and American foreign policy strategies, the issue of advancing religious freedom simply does not occur to them. It doesn't compute. And so, I'll end with this dive into the State Department a little bit. It's not surprising that if you ask, where does Ambassador Saperstein, the new ambassador at large religious, where does he work? Does he work, have the same status and the same level of the other ambassadors at large in the State Department? This is a very elevated diplomatic title, by the way. It's higher than an assistant secretary and lower than an undersecretary, for those of you who know those terms. The ambassador at large for women's issues, global women's issues, a very important issue, works directly for the Secretary of State. She is in the office of the Secretary of State, as is her staff. The same is true of the ambassador at large for coordination of global AIDS issues, works for the Secretary of State. Well, the ambassador at large for international religious freedom works for a lower-ranking official several levels removed from the Secretary of State. That shouldn't be surprising to anyone who realizes that this has not been integrated into our foreign policy in any sense, either for Miriam Ibrahim or, frankly, for anybody else. I hope that Ambassador Saperstein, who is a very capable man and understands what is at stake here and understands precisely what I'm saying to you now, will have an impact on this, and I urge people to support him. I will end by saying that he has very few resources. He has the entire world, but let's just boil it down to these 70-odd countries that are of vital significance to the United States, where religious freedom is virtually non-existent. He has very few resources to carry out any strategy if it did exist. That needs to change. And finally, I would argue that the United States needs to train its diplomats to do this. Now, to the credit of the Obama administration, it has instituted regular courses at the Foreign Service Institute on Religion and Foreign Policy, but they tend to be seminars where people come and argue about whether all this is constitutional and whether the CPC list should contain Burma or Tanzania. I mean, none of these are unimportant issues, but they don't train anybody to do anything. They are just seminars for people who don't have to come. They're not mandatory, and they tend to attract Foreign Service officers who have a little bit of time on their hands. It needs to be mandatory. It needs to be at regular intervals during the course of a Foreign Service officer's career, and it needs to be required. So let me end by saying that the suffering of Miriam Ibrahim and her husband and their family, I mean, as Tina said, one of their children were born in a terrible circumstances of a Sudanese prison. That is the face of religious persecution, and it is a riveting face. There are many others out there in the news today. The United States could be doing more to help these people. We can't solve the problem. We're not responsible for all these problems in the world. But it's in our interest, not just to the morally right thing to do, which I think it is, but we can help create stability. We can help create economic growth. We can help undermine religion-related terrorism, especially and including violent Islamist extremism and terrorism, by advancing international religious freedom as part of our own national security, as part of our fundamental foreign policy interests. So I'll end there. Thank you.
All right. Well, this is Christian Corgan again. I think we can go ahead and open it up to questions, but before we do that, so first what I'll say is if you'd like to ask a question, you can press star and then the pound key in a moment after you hear the prompt that says the floor mode is on. So I'll go ahead and turn the prompt on and let you get in line. But before we go and take a first question, Tina Ramirez, is there any? Do you have any follow-up thoughts to what Professor Farr said, or any additional thoughts adding on your initial presentation?
Yeah, no, thank you so much. I just really appreciate what Dr. Farr had to say, and I completely affirm everything, all of his experience. It's I worked in Congress with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom for about 10 years in Washington as well. And we worked on a lot of cases of people that were persecuted. And one of the most frustrating things was that we were always responding. We were never being proactive on anything in our foreign policy related to religious freedom. And one of the cases that we're seeing in the news right now, the effects of it, is Iraq. In Iraq, for about 3 years, we worked on trying to get the U.S., both under Bush and the Obama administration, under both, to recognize the importance of religious freedom, to make it a priority in our military intervention over there and in everything that we were doing. And it was never a priority. And because of that, it wasn't firmly embedded in the constitution in Iraq, and it was never prioritized in our interactions with either the Kurdish or the Baghdad governments. And so the minorities there never secured the rights that they needed in order to have the protection that would have prevented the crisis that we now see with ISIS in the north. There are a lot of preventative measures that need to be taken in our foreign policy, which Dr. Farr mentioned, and those are the things that are not happening. And because of that, it does have national security implications, but it has an impact on the human life internationally. I mean, what we see in Iraq right now is a result of a failure of a policy to recognize that religion is important, that you can't ignore religion when you're dealing with countries that will go the route of religious extremism and where minorities will then be basically wiped out, which is what we see happening and really seeing genocide, essentially. So there's so much that could have been done to have preempted that. And what I do with my organization is we are trying to, having worked in the government for so long or in that circle, seeing that really we are very reactionary to our policy. When I started Hardwired a couple years ago, the whole goal was essentially to go and train local leaders to be able to advocate for religious freedom as a matter of the larger human rights dialogue or democracy dialogue within their countries themselves, because ultimately help would come too late if they waited on foreign intervention. And then we also do train foreign governments. And so last summer, the Canadian government actually did a full day's worth of training with anybody that was interested in their foreign and International Trade Department on religious freedom and how to actually navigate cases like Miriam Ibrahim's, how to be proactive, how to, you know, respond when challenges come, how to make long-term impacts on these issues rather than just helping rescue somebody out of a country and then 5 years later you have another similar case you have to deal with. So the Canadians are definitely being very proactive in that sense. They have a new ambassador for international religious freedom that's been taking that on himself. But as Dr. Farr mentioned, the U.S. State Department has not done anything to that extent. And so many foreign service officers that I've had to interact with from the congressional side of things are very poorly trained on this issue, and they just do not know how to respond. And so typically their response is what Daniel Wani got last September 2013, when they said, well, she's not an American citizen, we can't help her, or religious freedom is against the U.S. Constitution, separation of church and state, we can't get involved in that. They're very ignorant responses, essentially. But if we were training our foreign service officers correctly to be proactive, to be diplomatic, which is what the International Religious Freedom Act says that they need to do, then those things wouldn't be happening. I hope that those things begin to change. But, you know, as Dr. Farr mentioned, we haven't seen those serious changes in the last 16 years of IRFA policy. So thank you I just felt that was important to share with everyone.
Great. Well, we have two questions pending that we'll get to, and we've got about 20 minutes or so for questions. So, yeah, we'll go right to our first question on the line.
Hello, this is John Farina from George Mason University. I'm very sympathetic with the sentiments that were expressed today, but I have a philosophical problem with the idea of enforcing religious liberty through international convention and law, and it's well illustrated in the case at hand. Miriam Ibrahim herself makes a determination that she has the ability to determine that it's her religious conviction that leads her to leave one faith and choose another, etc. And we want to rush to her aid for somewhat obvious reasons to many of those who are speaking, at least. But why and how can we deny that same religious liberty to the religious group that says this is against our religion, this is apostasy, it should be punished in certain ways? Religious freedom, if it means anything, we make that defense not on the basis of some other right, a right to association, a right to free speech or something. We make it as a religious freedom claim. Religious freedom claims, by their very nature, have as their basis the idea that the government is incompetent to make judgments about what is and what is not right religion. That's John Locke. So how do you do this?
Well, this is Tom. If I could jump in here, and then Tina, you can refine and correct. I think you answered, John, your question at the very end. Government is incompetent to do this. It's the basis of the answer to the question. Why should a religious group that wants to defend itself against apostasy not be required to do so? Here's my view here. The government, first of all, this was not a religious group defending itself. This was criminal law applied to a woman who exercised her conscience. So that's part of the answer. This was an illegitimate use of the criminal and police powers of the state to coerce the conscience. Now, I believe, I happen to be a Roman Catholic, that is perfectly legitimate and indeed quite reasonable for any religious group to be quite upset when anyone leaves its fold. But its response to this cannot be to seek the assistance of the state in coercing the conscience of the individual. And in fact, my reading of Dignitatis Humanae, which of course is the Catholic Declaration on Religious Liberty from 1965, is an explicit rejection of the proposition that there can be any coercion supported by the Catholic Church in matters of conscience. This does not mean that the Church changes its definition of what it is or what the consequences, moral and, if you like, eternal, might be for abandoning the faith. What Dignitatis says is that the Church no longer demands any privileged access to the police and civil powers of the state, criminal powers of the state, in order to keep people in the club, to coerce the conscience in any way. What it requires, what it demands of the state, is religious freedom, libertas ecclesiae, and it demands that, furthermore, for every other religious group. So to me, the answer to your very good question is that, and to put this back into the terms of what the United States government ought to be doing, we need to be finding ways to convince people in Sudan, or frankly, virtually every other country in the world that have these kinds of laws, that it is not in your interests to police apostasy and defamation and blasphemy by using the state. We're not asking you to consider them social goods. In fact, we agree they aren't. But the only answer to them has got to be to respond with better preaching and teaching, and to demand the right to make your claims publicly, but not to punish people, not to use the laws of apostasy. So I hope that at least addresses your question, whether you buy that or not.
All right, well, we've got one more question pending, and our lines will be open. So if you'd like to ask a question of either of our experts about their presentations or get their thoughts, press star and then the pound key.
Thank you. This is Sylvia Ross. I'm an attorney out here in Virginia. And firstly, I appreciate the background that you all gave, but sort of like the first question, I'm having a difficult time philosophically and practically thinking how the U.S. can do this. And this is why. If in these nations their constitutions are based on the Sharia law, and their all subsequent law, whether it's criminal code or not, is based on their constitutional law, that would then require us to look at, well, what is Sharia law? And if Sharia law is, according to Islamic authoritative treatises, the same books that we would look at to determine what our laws are, but in their laws, and it requires that apostasy is the divine and revealed will of Allah, and the sources confirm that, then we've sort of set the problem up that it can't happen. And I guess I just don't know how we can practically do this, because an Islamic judge to rule against the Sharia, if in their authoritative treatises it is the divine revealed will of Allah, then they would have to rule against God or the Prophet, and I don't think they're going to do that. And for an apostasy case, someone can be found not guilty of apostasy if they're insane. And I don't know the particulars of the one case about the man that was mentioned, but perhaps that was an angle for the judge to take and why he wound up in an insane asylum. Or I may have misunderstood the facts, but I don't know how we can do that if we set up countries where the countries themselves establish their constitutions on Sharia law, then that is the source for all their subsequent law. How do you practically do that? Because you can impose Western constitutional ideas on them. That's my question, is how do you practically do it?
I could respond to that if that's okay. Tom, do you want me to go ahead and start?
Yeah, please, and then I'll follow
yeah.
up.
Okay, so when I do trainings in foreign countries, such as Sudan, we are looking at a number of different of things. First, we're looking at what international law says. And international law is pretty consistent, as Tom mentioned earlier, about what religious freedom is. But it's very complicated for a lot of people to understand. Most people that have signed on to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights or have are part of the United Nations automatically have acceded to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, essentially. And Article 18 on religious freedom is very clear that you have the right to have a religion, to choose a religion, to change your religion, and to not be coerced into something that you don't believe. So these are all very clear, fundamental normative standards of international law that go, whether there is a universal declaration or an international covenant, whether somebody signed it or not, they're all considered basically the law of the world, that you really can't go against that, whether you accede to it or not. But the fact is that most countries of the world have, and so it's a very useful basis for locals to use when they're trying to advocate for their human rights, because what you have happening in these countries is you have human beings trying to violate the rights and dignity of their citizens in order to, you know, impose their particular views, whatever that might be. And so you have to have human rights as individual human rights in order for them to be able to respond, to stand up for the fact that, you know, we are human beings and we have certain rights, and that's the way they can challenge their governments. Now, there are many countries in the world that have apostasy laws. There are 20 that put people to death for apostasy. There are many other countries, I think 80 to 90 plus, that have blasphemy, anti-conversion, and other defamation type of laws. And so these are a major problem around the world. However, I don't think that you could say that because many of these laws are in countries that have Sharia, that it's reflective necessarily only of Sharia. I think what it's reflective of is the ruling parties that want to impose their view of Sharia or their view of Islamic law on the rest of the public. So if you look in Iraq, for instance, the Islamic State or Daesh has been probably murdering more Shia than and Yazidis than anyone else, because they consider them heretics. And so it's actually more dangerous to be a Muslim right now than a Christian in parts where ISIS is controlling Iraq. In the sense that you will get beheaded, you will be just shot to death, essentially, because they have no, under their idea of the law of Islam, that's what they should do. So for Christians, it's convert or die. For Shias and other heretics, it's just, we're going to kill you. In Sudan, there, one of the remarkable things that happened with Miriam's case is that the public came behind her to support her. It was a grassroots movement that basically said to Bashir, we don't like your law, we don't want it imposed on people, and we think it's inconsistent with Islam, with our constitution, with what we want in our country, with international law, with a number of things. It was the people saying that. And the people have every right to challenge that by saying, this is not a standard of human dignity around the world that we want. We want the true standard. And that's what we are trying to help people understand and articulate on their own from within whatever religious or philosophical framework they come from. And so that's why we worked with Miriam's Muslim lawyers. That's why we work with, you know, Muslims all over the world or people of all different faiths, is that you need to help them understand why religious freedom is in their interest and in the interest of their countries, in order for everybody to have true freedom. Because if Miriam didn't get her freedom, the women in Sudan knew that they would never have freedom either. When I was working with two of the top women's rights leaders in Sudan about a year and a half ago, they went back to Sudan and they argued successfully for the adoption of religious freedom provision in the new constitution, or one of the draft constitutions, because they said, as women, we know that if we do not stand for religious freedom, we will be doubly persecuted, whether we're Muslim or Christian. And so they went back and argued successfully to get it adopted. Ethnic minorities from Darfur and people from other parts of Sudan began to say the same thing. And so at Miriam's trial, you had even the leading Muslim party, the Ummah party, making statements and speaking at a press conference in support of Miriam, saying, this is not the religious freedom. This is not the way we want people to be treated in Sudan. Religious freedom doesn't mean they should be put to death. There's a different way to interpret the Islamic law. So I think that it's very important to understand that Muslims are probably one of the most affected groups by these laws around the world. The first person affected by the apostasy law in Sudan actually was Muhammad Mahmoud Taha back in 1985. He was actually put to death. Because he was a reformer and he was challenging the Islamic system. That was before they even had a criminal law putting people to death, ironically. But since then, no one has been put to death. Miriam's case was the first where somebody had actually been convicted and sentenced to death. And so it was going to be very interesting to see what had happened there. But Muslims throughout Sudan came in her support because I think that they, since the CPA, and many of them that were longtime supporters of Taha and part of the Reformist Party, realized that this is not what we want for Sudan, and we have an opportunity now, this golden opportunity, to really push for what was articulated in that comprehensive peace agreement for religious freedom. And we know that all of us are in this together, whether we're women or we're children or we're Christian or Muslim or whatever, that if we don't have true freedom of religion and conscience for everyone, this dictator, Bashir, is going to simply oppress us more and more and more, and none of us will ever have the freedom that we desire. So I hope that answers your question. It is important to look at, to build our arguments within the culture. It's not an imposition of Western civilization. This is international law that these countries have acceded to. These are things that human beings around the world want. And even, you know, Bashir wants his version of religion applied on everybody. So to get back to the other question about why can't he's restricted in what he can do to others within human rights and international law that says you can't violate somebody else's human right just to say that you're exercising your freedom. So just because you have the freedom of religion doesn't mean you have the freedom to impose that religion or belief on somebody else. Now, within a religious community, as Dr. Farr mentioned, you can make the choice of shunning someone, let's say, that would leave your faith, but you do not have a right to in any way harm that person or force them to believe something that they don't. You can't go into their conscience. That's the part of religious freedom that's off limits, essentially. So anyway, I'm happy to explain more if that doesn't get to it, but maybe Dr. Farr wants to mention something else.
Well, I think that was a very good, Tina. Sylvia, I mean, if I understood your question, it was basically, how can you root this out? It's so deeply rooted in the Sharia, and I think Tina's answer is helps to make the point that it is quite deeply rooted in some of these Muslim-majority countries, less so in others. It is we can put all these laws sort of in a basket, not just anti-apostasy, but also anti-blasphemy and anti-defamation. It's basically the notion that if you offend Islam, either by leaving it or by defaming the Prophet or the kinds of things that we're hearing from ISIS, then you deserve punishment. And your question was, given the fact that your premise is that it's so deeply rooted in Sharia, it's required by God, how can the United States ever get rid of this stuff? And I think the first point to be made is the one that Tina was making quite well, and that is that it really does vary in its roots and its understanding across the Muslim-majority world. Now, that said, that doesn't mean that it is not going to be difficult to root out, but I think to put it in an odd way, ISIS may be helping us in this regard, because what it is doing is showing us what a gateway to extremism these laws and these practices are. This notion that if you offend my religion, you must be slaughtered, you must be stoned or burned or decapitated. The answer to that, as I tried to say before, is you don't have to avoid being offended. What you have to do is avoid using violence to defend your religion. And I think there are many Muslims, in part thanks to ISIS and some of the other extremists around the world, like Boko Haram in Nigeria, like Al-Shabaab in Somalia, the one that threatened to do something at the Mall of the Americas over the last couple of days, the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, the Al-Nusra Front, and on, the Taliban. All of them share this capacity to one degree or another for violence in defense of Islam. If the Iraqis and the Egyptians, to take two countries whose citizens, whether they're Muslim or Christian, have been slaughtered by these people as a result of this, it seems to me there's an opening for us to say, look, 1,200 years, 1,300 years into its own history, Christianity had laws and practices against apostasy and blasphemy that were in the theological resources were different, but that the outcome was often the same, the use of violence to punish in order to dissuade others. These things have changed in Christianity. It's taken a long time for them to change. I mentioned the Catholic doctrine on religious liberty. You know, that's pretty late in the modern world to come in 1965, and we don't have hundreds of years. So just to sum up my answer to your very good question, how do you do this? This is something Tina said. We have to appeal to the self-interests of these people. If you can't figure out Iraq or Egypt, and this is an argument for democracies or would-be democracies, it's easier to make than it is for a place like Sudan or Saudi Arabia. But if you are struggling to have a democracy, you're not going to have security, you're not going to have social harmony, you're not going to have economic growth, you're not going to have jobs, you're not going to have any of the things that you want as a country unless you can work out this issue of religion-related violence and grant full equality under the law to all of your citizens. And this is means, at the end of the day, you cannot use the state to punish those who offend your religion. You have to deal with it in a nonviolent way. But I will just end with this. I recognize that this is a lot easier said than done. And you wouldn't do it, as both of the questions have used the word philosophically. This is not, to me, an academic discussion. It is not a discussion solely about laws or international norms. It is about the national interests of the United States. If it is in our interest not only to try to save people like Miriam Ibrahim, but to stabilize these terribly unstable countries where our national interests, where our blood and treasure have both been poured out, which I think it is, unarguably, we have got to integrate religious freedom into this. Religious freedom is a lot cheaper than a drone, let alone 1,000 drones, and it is infinitely less expensive than the blood of our youth. We should be trying this. It's worthwhile. It will be hard, but it can be done. Thanks.
All right. Well, we have just a few minutes left on the call, so let's do a last call for questions. If you'd like to get on, we probably have time to field one more. All right. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both of our experts for joining us today and for providing such thoughtful commentary and presentations. Thank you to our audience for joining us. As a reminder, that you can find the podcast of this teleforum, as well as all of our previous teleforum conference calls, on our website at www.fedsoc.org. So until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.